Who's here for the first time today? So just a couple of you. So good luck.
The percent's too low to get
there. I'll just say a couple brief things in a moment so you won't feel like you just walked in the movie in the middle here. But for others as well, we are working with the themes from my recent book, Come Out My People, which I'm told the bookstore ordered 10 more copies of, and they should be here tomorrow, with the bus coming up tomorrow. And if you've been part of this for a day or three or whatever, and you've enjoyed it, and you'd like to offer a word, this is my copy, and it's one of my little traditions to invite people to sign it and write something in it. So, you know, if I don't know your name, you might want to put Holden 2011 or something, just so I remember who was that. So when we're done, or any time that you see me, if you'd like to put something in there, that'd be great.
Will you do the same for our company?
I would, yes. I'm glad to. Okay, I think we're ready to start. So we're continuing today, looking at Genesis, especially the early chapters, with two lenses. One is looking at it in its cultural context, and the argument that I've been making here and in the book is that regardless of what oral traditions there may have been and whatever pre-strands there may have been before we got to the final copy, that it was largely composed in the context of Babylonian exile. And today in particular, our texts will show how clear that is and how little the passages we'll look at in Genesis 10 and 11 would make any sense in any other context, except in the broad sense that we'll look at today. But for the time of composition, that certainly makes the most sense. The other thing is that the primary lens of the entire book is to see that the Hebrew Bible contains two competing religions. Religion in the sense of worldview and practices that make a people a people. So when we look at the Hebrew scripture as presenting something called Judaism, we miss the fact that there's a great plurality of perspectives there, and they tend to coalesce at two ends of a spectrum. One end of that spectrum, and I'll just put it up here briefly for those who are new, or just to remind you, I call the religion of empire and the other the religion of creation. And as we've looked at before, and you can just glance at today, and the series of features that provide elements of what any, you know, full religion would claim to offer an explanation of and practice of, the religion of empire is exactly the opposite of the religion of creation. And so the book of Genesis, although not the first book written during the Babylonian exile, several hundred years after the earliest texts, is a clear expression of this religion of creation. And it's one that is manifest often in the New Testament. And so as I have this table here that shows from the other end of the book, shows how Jesus consistently sided with what I'm calling the religion of creation and against the religion of empire. And Genesis is often a text that Jesus calls on, either explicitly or implicitly. You know, three of the four Gospels start with a, you know, intertextual reference to Genesis. So most explicitly, John's Gospel, in the beginning was the Word. But even Mark and Matthew start with the phrase, in the beginning, which is a clear reference back to Genesis. So as we look at Genesis, and we look at the particular passages we'll look at today, we're seeing how it was this expression in the particular situation of Babylonian exile, trying to lead its audience to reject the religion of empire as it was expressed in the Babylonian creation story and practice. Babylonian creation story known as the Enuma Elish. And also all the visible manifestation of that in the city of Babylon. Its architecture, its social hierarchy, its wall that separated the divine realm inside the city from the chaos outside the city. To try to give its audience a religion that would bind them together differently than the people otherwise in Babylon were bound together. Okay. So we've looked Monday at the creation stories in chapter 1 and 2, and yesterday at the expulsion from the garden and the building of the first city by the first murderer whose back is turned from God, Cain. And we're going to pick that up today I'm just going to run briefly through the chapters 5 to 9 in just a few moments, just to connect the narrative context where we're going to focus in chapters 10 and 11. And as a couple people mentioned to me this morning, just over coffee and breakfast, I recognize that you as a group come with a wide variety of perspectives and educations. And some of you are, seminary trained, and some of you have never read the Bible seriously. So if I'm going too fast, or if you have a question, don't hesitate to go, wait a minute, slow down, or explain that again, or I'm confused. And I don't feel like I have a set amount of material to cover here, and even if I do, so what? anything I don't cover today, we can talk about later and some other time. So, chapter 4 ends with this little poem song from Cain about vengeance, about Lamech, rather, Cain's descendant, about vengeance. And then we get to a genealogy. And for our ears, genealogies are boring, And one of the things about this genealogy that often confuses people, and it's one of those things that I wonder what the literalists do with it, with these long lifespans, 800 and 900 and something years, etc. They certainly were not meant to be literal. What they are, each of them, and the Jewish scholar Umberto Cassuto is the first one who really showed this systematically, each one of them is a little number parody of the Babylonian base six number system. And they're also a parody of the fact that one of the claims of the Babylonians, through what they had as an ancestral king list, was that the city of Babylon itself, having been made by the gods, according to Enuma Elish, came down to the present world of Babylonians through the reign of a series of kings, each of whom reigned these long mythological-like periods, like 10,000 years. So these Babylonian or Sumerian king lists were were evident at the time Genesis was written. And so rather than presenting the reigns of kings of Babylon who reigned for these enormous periods, Genesis presents a list of human ancestors whose lives were long, but not nearly as long as the Babylonian king list. And one of them stands out. And I'm just going to mention this as a hint because later in the book, and we're not going to talk about it this week or next, is important to connect here. And that's in verse 22 and 24. Let me move that up a little farther. Actually, 21 to 24. About Enoch. When Enoch had lived 65 years, he became the father of Methuselah. And Enoch walked with God after the birth of Methuselah 300 years and had other sons and daughters. Thus, all the days of Enoch were 365 years. Enoch walked with God. Then he was no more because God took him. Whatever that means. What in the world does that mean? He was no more because God took him. And the text just moves on. Now, one hint is the number of years. You notice something about how long he lived?
365.
Ring a bell?
Oh!
A year, a solar year, a solar year, because the Babylonians practiced a lunar year. And this is, I'm just going to throw out a theme that I'm going to move away from, but it's one that's interesting to reflect on historically, is one of the things that empires do is determine how time is measured. Whether it's the number of days of the year, or the number of days of a week, or what a work week is, or whether you measure time by, as we hear in Luke's Gospel, in the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar, empires tell you what time it is. And that's how your life is shaped. So the Babylonians told you what time it was in relation to the moon, and the Israelites said, no, we're going to tell time in relation to the sun. And of course, they were right in the physical sense, but Enoch's an expression of that. And the reference to later texts is there's a very important but often not recognized the importance of collection of apocalyptic texts from the Second Temple period, which is to say from roughly the 4th century to the time of Jesus, 4th century BCE to the time of Jesus, collected under the rubric First Enoch. And the texts were written over several hundred years, but the voice speaking throughout the text is purportedly this Enoch. And the idea is that because he didn't die, but was taken to God, that gave him a perspective on reality, gave him God, a God's eye perspective that then could be conveyed. Now, whether the authors of that thought that was literally true or that's a literary device, impossible to answer. But it's rooted in this here. And the book of First Enoch is actually very influential in the New Testament. It generates many of the things that distinguish the New Testament from the Hebrew Scripture in ways that we often don't think about. For example, the idea that after death, there's a judgment. You don't see that anywhere in Hebrew Scripture. That there are competing bands of angels, that there are good angels and bad angels. Don't see that anywhere in Hebrew Scripture. Both Matthew and Luke are clearly influenced by First Enoch. So just a little tidbit to suggest something. And another piece of First Enoch, in fact the oldest part, takes its narrative from these very mysterious verses at the beginning of chapter 6 in Genesis, which many scholars and certainly many ordinary readers go, what's going on there? When people began to multiply on the face of the ground and daughters were born of them, the sons of God saw that they were fair and they took wives for themselves of all that they chose. The sons of God. Then the Lord said, my spirit shall not abide in mortals forever, for they are flesh, their days shall be 120 years. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterward, when the sons of God went into the daughters of humans who bore children to them. These were the heroes that were of old, warriors of renown. And the text doesn't tell you who the heck are the Nephilim. And what does it mean, the sons of God? You know, before Jesus, what does sons of God mean? Well, in First Enoch, the author takes that as an expression of the kinds of ancient kings who saw themselves precisely as sons of God. Which, of course, in the much later Roman Empire was very explicit. That Emperor Augustus, for example, one of his titles was explicitly Son of God. One that he could claim because he ritually had his father Julius rise up to Olympus in what was called an apotheosis, you know, a going up to the gods. And so if his father Julius was now a god, then of course Augustus was a son of a god. So when we hear the title Son of God for Jesus, it's not because it didn't already have a resonance precisely with the themes I'm trying to look at here, which is in the religion of empire, what's claimed is that human beings who have power over other human beings have that power directly from God. And Jesus, of course, stands precisely against that. But it's an ancient claim. Every ancient empire, Babylonian, Egyptian, Phoenician, Greek, Roman, claimed that. Otherwise, when we stop to think about it, what would give one human being that kind of power over other human beings? Why would people accept it? Why would you allow one fellow human to dominate you as a people, to eat off gold plates, to have all the weapons, to, you know, live the high life while the rest of you are slaves and grunt workers, unless it was divinely authorized? Otherwise, you'd rebel and say, you'd say, like Joseph's brothers say to him, you know, are you to rule over us? After he has his little dream about his their sheaves bowing down to his sheave. And of course, their response is, let's kill him. No? Which is a very human response of someone who says, I'm going to be your boss. Says who? I had a dream. Yeah, okay. Let's see what this dreamer thinks when we, you know, sell him to the Ishmaelites. So it was an ancient claim that human power over other humans was given by the gods. That's what the first book of Enoch takes out of this little mysterious passage in Genesis 6 and then expands in the context of its cultural context, which is the time period of Alexander the Great, who quite explicitly claimed that power. that the gods had made him king over all the earth. Okay? And the response then of Yahweh, or the Lord in this translation after that, is one of the most astounding verses in Genesis and in the entire Bible. And this translation covers it pretty well, so I just want us to just to consider the depth of this one verse. The Lord saw that the wickedness of humankind was great in the earth, and that every inclination of the thoughts of their hearts was only evil continually. Every inclination of the thoughts of their heart. Like, you know, not just their thoughts, but the inclination of their thoughts. You know, the direction your thoughts are inclining. Always evil continually. Wow. How far this has come from Genesis 1, when God made human beings and said, it's all very good. Made in the divine image, and now it's nothing but evil thoughts. And God, and this translation was sorry, or other translations regretted he had made humankind in the earth, and it grieved him to his heart. And so he's going to blot them out, except for Noah. And we could have a whole session on Noah. I'm not going to for the sake of time. Noah, of course, has no speaking part at all. He's very obedient, but not very personal. Like, there's not a lot you learn about Noah, except after the flood, when he's dying for a drink. Right? I mean, it says after the flood, the first thing he does is plant a vineyard, and then he got drunk. I mean, imagine if you had to wait for the vineyard to grow. But before that, the text really emphasizes what the issue is. How that evil inclination is manifest. And so we see that here again repeated, so in case you don't miss it, in a structured way in verse 11 and 12. The earth was corrupt in God's sight, and the earth was filled with violence. And God saw that the earth was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted its ways upon the earth. So there's a sad irony there. The divine command was to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth with life. And instead, people have filled the earth with violence. And there's something beautiful and tragic about the whole flood story, of course. And anybody who comes in with presuppositions from Greek philosophy, not from the Bible, that gives God these attributes like omniscient and, you know, all-powerful and all these things, has not read this text. Because who's God blaming for why humankind has this flaw?
Humankind.
What's that?
Humankind.
No, himself.
Himself. He's the creator. He made us flawed, he's saying. And
I'll start over again.
I'll start over again, except it doesn't work. It seems like Genesis is saying built into this relationship between a God and creatures in the divine image, who on our own want to reach out and be more godlike so that we can manipulate things according to our ways. And then from God's side is wanting us to be godlike in the sense of in the divine image, and yet that necessarily seems to carry that we use it for violence and power. And the flood does not at all solve the problem. I mean, maybe if you'd wiped out Noah and come up with another version, you know, humans 2.0 or something. But, of course, that's not, Genesis is saying, not possible. This struggle ultimately manifests in what I'm calling these two religions, these temptations at one level to move toward manipulating the earth and all of our life to fit our desire to be in control, rather than submit to the will of our Creator, in that process that as Sue's been working in the spiritual practices thing, that we have such mixed feelings about holy obedience, because obedience and submission are words that make us feel like we've lost our freedom to be human and someone's telling us what to do, and that's true if it's Hitler or a corporation or whatever, but when it's God telling us what to do, is there something wrong with that exactly? But that's the tension in our life, and that Genesis is recognizing in the social world of its own time. So the flood happens, and then Noah you know, gets drunk, and his kids uncover his nakedness, and we won't get to that whole story right now. And then we get to the Table of Nations in chapter 10. And again, it's one of those things that most of us go, you know, and it's just a series of names, some of which are familiar and some of which aren't, and we think, so what? But I'd like to suggest that this is one of the most important unexamined texts in the Bible. Especially the center part here, which is so key to so much. And so I want to look at it in a little bit of detail. There's a sequence of descendants, and they're all a bunch of names, and after verse 12, it's just more names. But in chapter 10 here, verse 8 to 12, there's a break. So in the midst of the genealogy, there's this little narrative. Cush became the father of Nimrod. He was the first on earth to become a mighty warrior. The Hebrew word there is gibor, which can mean a warrior. It's also the same word that's used in this translation in verse 9 for hunter. So in other words, someone who uses violence as a means of power, whether against humans or against animals, is not clear from the word itself. And then different translations render the first part of verse 9, which is central, differently, some in a very misleading way. So this New Revised Standard here says he was a mighty hunter before the Lord. The literal says he was a mighty hunter in Yahweh's face. Lepanim Yahweh. The New Jerusalem Bible is the one that renders it the worst. It says he was a mighty hunter by the grace of Yahweh, which gives divine approval to empire. Before carries some of the connotation, but I think the literal, I don't know why most Bibles don't translate it literally, that in Yahweh's face says a lot. And it's one of those idioms that translates pretty well into current English, because to be in somebody's face is to challenge them for control and authority. You know, get out of my face. And we think we have other words not so direct that are conveying the same point. To confront someone. Right? You put your fronts together.
Face off.
Face off. Exactly. So Nimrod is building a kingdom in Yahweh's face. And the word beginning here, Bereshit in Hebrew in verse 10, is only in Genesis 1:1 and here in 10:10. It's easy to remember numerically as it happens. So this is a new beginning, a counter-beginning, if you will. There's the beginning of creation in Genesis 1, and now there's the beginning of empire, human-made empire, in 10:10. Now again, that's over against Enuma Elish, which says empire was in the beginning, that those are simultaneous. In the Enuma Elish story, the coming into being of the creatures of the earth and the coming into being of the Babylonian Empire are simultaneous. They're basically the same event. But Genesis takes a very different view. No, the Creator made the heavens and the earth and all that's in them and made them all good and made humans very good, but something went wrong and humans made a counter-creation of empire. And quite plainly, we recognize some of the places here. Babel, of course, Babylon, and Erech, which is actually one of the ancient cities in the Babylonian city-state empire, as well as Akkad, all in the land of Shinar. And I've got just a little map here that gives you just some hint of the area we're talking about. So you can see the color coding illustrates the three children of Noah that then their descendants are supposedly the founders of kingdoms and places in these three parts of their known world. So the Hamites here are in northern Africa, and of course primarily it manifests itself in Egypt as the enemy of the Israelites. And then the Japheth folks are up in the north, in the red on this map, areas that don't come up so much in the biblical narrative. And then the Shemites are here in the Arabian, what we know as the Arabian Peninsula, but not all of it, because, of course, there's the Babylonian Empire and its cities right there in the plain of Shinar in what we might call Mesopotamia, you know, from the Greek word meaning between the rivers, between the Tigris and the Euphrates, east of Eden. Okay? So that's the beginning of this counter kingdom. And then it goes on to say, he went into Assyria and built Nineveh, Rehoboth, Ir, Kala, and Resen, between Nineveh and Kala. That is the great city. Now, grammatically in Hebrew, it's difficult to know which of these named cities is linked to the phrase at the end, the great city. And it actually doesn't matter so much. Although in the book of Jonah, which is one of the only other places in the Hebrew scripture the term the great city is used, it's explicitly Nineveh. Jonah is told to go prophesy before that great city, Nineveh, that supposedly takes several days to walk across, which is exaggeration for the purpose of making a point. And the whole book of Jonah's, you know, exaggeration for the purpose of making a point. But it's indicating that there was this tradition of something called the great city. And I just want to highlight where we hear that again. Oops. At the other end of the Bible, and why this is so important. And it's the fallen Babylon, the great city. This is in Revelation 18, where John of Patmos, the speaker, hears this voice of a mighty angel calling out, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. It has become a dwelling place of demons, a haunt of every foul and hateful bird, a haunt of every foul and hateful beast. For all the nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. And the kings of the earth have committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth have grown rich from the power of her luxury. Then I heard another voice from heaven saying, 'Come out of her, my people, so you do not take part in her sins, and you do not share in her plagues,'" etc. A little earlier in Revelation, the beginning of the vision of fallen Babylon, it's explicitly described as the great city. So we see here this well-dressed prostitute in scarlet and purple with jewels and gold and pearls, etc., on her forehead a name, Babylon the Great, Mother of Whores. And it's explicitly described as the great city, as we see up here at the end of chapter 16. So the perspective of the great city, starting at least in the narrative sequence here in Genesis 10, reaches its culmination at the very opposite end of the biblical canon in Revelation. And I won't spend too much time talking about the book of Revelation, but what's clear in the book of Revelation, which is the most explicit and the easiest place to see the contrast that I'm trying to make in this book between the religion of empire and the religion of creation, with Babylon, of course, as the expression of religion of empire, and New Jerusalem as the expression of religion of creation, is that Babylon, of course, as a historical phenomenon, didn't exist at the time of John of Patmos in the late first century. The empire that was manifest as the enemy of God's people at that time was, of course, Rome. But what's often missed in the study of the book of Revelation, and I think somewhere in the Holden Archives, or a series I did a decade ago here on Revelation, so I don't know if you can find them or not, but anyway, is this question of whether the book of Revelation was meant to be about Rome or meant to be about the future. And of course, it's been read as about the current moment from the second century forward to this day, when people are looking at it as signs of the times and expressions of various things in our world. I think what's missed is, and the reason why it can be read that way is, it's about the always ongoing reality of this manifestation of this counter-creation. Figuratively presented as Babylon, I'm calling more generically empire, which is always out there and always continues to be replicated. And that the Bible, in this religion of creation swath from Genesis forward to the Gospels and finally with the book of Revelation, is continuously calling God's people to come out from being associated and identified with that and come back to being identified with the realm of the Creator. Or as Jesus calls it, the kingdom of God. One of the things, just from a social, political standpoint, but it also has theological implications, is why it is that humans continue to fall for it. To continue to put our trust in these human-made systems of domination and violence and exploitation. Because if there's one thing we know about human-made empires, they have a 100% failure rate. Despite their claims, Rome, the Eternal City, Hitler's thousand-year Reich, which lasted all of 12 years, you know, they're always claiming to be eternal, and they always fall. So why do we keep falling for it? When, of course, it's God's creation that lasts. That's more ancient and more eternal than anything we can do. And no matter what we do, even with something as horrible as climate change, the earth will survive, I think. We might not, but the earth will. And we'll adapt, just like it's adapted to ice ages and, you know, asteroid hits and all kinds of other things over the billions of years. So Genesis is trying to get its audience to reject the moment of Babylon's existence that it's living in, but this religion of creation throughout is taking that to be the eternal struggle of God's people to come out of empire. So again, feel free to jump in with questions. I know I'm doing all the talking here, but if you have questions on this, feel free to jump in. So the genealogy continues, and then we get to the summary, and then we get to chapter 11. And I'm going to spend the rest of our time on these beautiful, incredible 9 verses. The Tower of Babel story is one of the most elegantly constructed passages in the Bible. Let's look at one example of how you can see it. So here you can see it in the form of what scholars call a chiasm, which is simply a way that texts were arranged so that the beginning and the end match each other and there are mirrored parts in the middle. And much of the Bible actually is formed in chiasm, John's Gospel especially, which is all chiastic from beginning to end. And so even in these just 9 verses, there it goes A through G and then back with these parallel things. But it's also a side-by-side parallel panel. So the first 4 verses also match the last 4 verses, as you can see here with the question of one people and one language, and the seemingly innocuous word there, but we'll get to it in a minute of why that's important, and then building a city and the name, and then the question of being scattered and the fact of being scattered. Okay? So it's both this series of concentric circles in a way, but also side-by-side panels. In other words, it's very carefully constructed, which is to say, it's doing with words what the tower in the story is doing with bricks. It's carefully building words up together to present something in contrast to what the people in the story are doing with bricks. And as the Hebrew illustrates, which you can't hear in English, there are a number of key words that are repeated over and over again, and then there's also sound play in Hebrew that we can't hear in English because a number of the words use the same 3 Hebrew consonants, what in English come out as B, L, and N, near each other. So it not only looks that way visually, if you map it out in terms of the structure as I showed you, but it sounds that way too in the original language. And again, remember when we looked at Genesis 1, the contrast between how the Enuma Elish says creative things happen through violence, and Genesis claims no, creative things happen through words. God's creation happens through words. So it's using words to tear down the Babylonian story and reality. Okay? I put up here a series of passages where the question of building is used in Genesis. The kinds of things that are built. And so I just want to note that as we look here. So the first thing is that Yahweh builds a woman. Most translations don't allow you to hear that it's from the same Hebrew verb. Cain built a city, which we looked at yesterday. We just skipped over where Noah built an altar. As I note there, the ark is not described as having been built in the same language. Nimrod built Nineveh and these other cities. And in this passage, the people say, let us build ourselves a city and a tower. And then Abram builds an altar. Sarah builds children. by Hagar, and Jacob builds a house. So that's another interesting theme you might follow of what's involved in building and who does the building in Genesis. And then there's just, I guess I won't read all these, but just some scholars' comments on the importance of the Tower of Babel story. I like Michael Fishbane, the Jewish scholar's one here. I'll just read that one and you can glance at the others. It suggests a profound realization of the energies and will to self-deification which build culture. In fact, the achievements of culture are portrayed with sarcasm. The human drive for social achievement is thus, the drive to build a bulwark of works against the fear of death and dispersion. So, there's a number of other writers who've said very profound things about what's going on in what, at one level, is an incredibly simple story. So we won't look at every detail, but I just want to say some of those things to encourage you in your own time to just look at it more closely. So let's just look at a few elements of this. So it starts off with, now the whole earth had one language and the same words. Okay, good thing, bad thing? Doesn't say yet. And as they migrated from the east, they came upon a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. And they said to one another, come, let us make bricks, or literally in the Hebrew it says, let us brick bricks. The verb and the noun are the same. And burn them thoroughly. And they had brick for stone and bitumen for mortar. Now that's the key right there. And the rest is just sort of logical consequences. Why are they making these bricks in verse 3? Don't go to verse 4. Just in verse 3, why are they making these bricks?
No,
we don't know that yet. See, that's why I wanted, that's a later thought. It doesn't say that in verse 3. It doesn't say, let's make a tower. How do you make a tower? Well, first we need to make bricks. So I'm trying to highlight here. It says, let us make bricks. Then they said, let's build a city and a tower. So why are they making the bricks in verse 3?
Just houses?
To achieve immortality.
How do you know that, Dave?
Well, I think because a brick, before it's brick, it's dirt.
Right, clay okay. in this context.
Okay, after they make a brick, then it's a rock.
Yeah, in fact, it says explicitly, they had brick for stones. In other words, they had a human-made thing as a substitute for a God-made thing.
Yeah.
Brick instead of stone, bitumen for mortar.
Yeah, for mortar.
Okay. But still, why are they doing it?
To be God.
They've got people that they need to keep busy.
I think that's a nice answer. Yeah.
Do they have slaves?
We don't know. It just says they're all, right now, it's all this unity. The whole earth had one language, and they migrated together, and they said to one another, it's like all this grand unity. Doesn't say anybody's in charge. There's no hierarchy stated here. There's a fresh story. I'd like to suggest they do it because they can. You know? Just because you can. And so because you can is the first response, and then the question is, what do you do with bricks? I don't know, let's stack them up. And make a name for ourselves. Like kids on the beach, making sandcastles. Or, I don't know if any of you have ever been out to the Olympic Peninsula where there's the Dungeon of Spit. Anybody been to Dungeon of Spit out there? It's a wonderful place if you're not from the Northwest, never been there. It's 5 miles of sand that goes out into the Strait of Juan de Fuca, and one side is on the surf side, if you will, and the other side's on the quiet side. And so on the surf side, there's an enormous amount of driftwood. And Sue and I were there one day, toward the end of the day, and it was all lined up with like forts and things that kids had made. And the ranger was taking them all apart. And I thought, kind of sad that, you know, they'd put all this work, and he said, I do it every day. Every day the kids build them up, and every day I take them down. Primarily for legal reasons, I think, they're like not safe. But it's just to say, you see a pile of driftwood, and you think, let's make something. You know, it's this human urge to build. But so kids are doing it just for fun. Yeah, Doug, you had a comment?
Yeah, it's again another version of God creates us in God's image. What does God do? God is a creator.
Yeah.
And so there's something very powerful and very beautiful about this imagining of creative work.
Yes.
And yet at the same time, we see where it leads potentially.
Yeah, and we're not quite there in the text yet. But it's because, exactly, right. We have hands, we have opposable thumbs, we have minds, you know, we can take clay, we can have one, we can imagine bricks, and we can make them. Somebody else had a hand?
Yeah,
Yeah, on the other side of this country, there's a little island off the coast of Maine called Mahegan Island. It's only 2.5 square miles. It's 12 miles out in the ocean. But as you walk the island, there's a place called Cathedral of the Pines. And as you walk through there, people build what they call fairy houses. Mm-hmm. And they build these little structures out of whatever's found around. Yeah. And you see hundreds of them as you walk through the pines.
Yeah. And it's a universal thing, isn't it? You have a comment over here, too?
Yeah. What is considered the whole Earth at this point?
Well, that's a good question. The map I just showed you a minute ago is pretty much what they knew as the whole Earth.
So therefore, the language could all be one language, because certainly there were other peoples in the
Yeah, this is a story. Okay, this is not history. This is a story. So it's presenting a situation where imagine everybody has the same language. What would that mean? Now, what's implicit in that is that's what empires do. Empires have everybody speak the imperial language, like English. Before that, Spanish. Right? Why people in South America speak Spanish? Right? They're not from Spain.
Or Portuguese.
Portuguese, or in the ancient world, Greek. Or in the Western Roman Empire, Latin, because it's important for empires to have a language that everybody can share. It doesn't say that explicitly it's a function of empire. In fact, it's reversing it in terms of the order of sequence of which comes first, the language or the structure. But that's the question that's at issue. Okay, so they make their bricks, and then they say, come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens, in other words, literally a skyscraper, right? Skyscraper, top in the heavens. And let us make a name for ourselves, otherwise we shall be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. So, it's gone from little fairy houses and forts on the beach to let us make a name for ourselves. Now it's striving to be something that achieves some kind of immortality. Something that will enable them to be remembered and honored for their construction. It's not no longer just something just for our own pleasure and for fun and to occupy the day in a harmless way, but so we'll make a name for ourselves, and we'll remember that tomorrow when we look at the contrasting story of the call of Abram, which is closely connected with the story, but it had to divide them somehow. So today we'll do 10 and 11, tomorrow we'll do 12 and 13, but it'll be the flip side of the story. And then I hope you can hear in verse 5 that this is meant to be wonderful satire. The Lord came down to see the city and the tower which mortals had built. Yeah, you're a great group. You already laugh at that. Sometimes I've explained to people why that's funny. You know, it's not because, you know, God has bad eyesight. It's because this thing that humans would make to scrape the sky is so small from the Creator's perspective, you can't even see it from there. You know, you got to come. What is it? What is it they're doing way down there? You know? And so there it is. And so the Lord said, look, they are one people. They all have one language. And this is only the beginning of what they will do. Nothing that they propose to do will now be impossible for them. Okay. So if they can build the city and tower and make a name for themselves, it'll just lead to nuclear weapons or whatever, you know. So, come, let us go down... Us, there. Somebody mentioned on Monday the question of the plurality of God in the Genesis 1 story, and here it is again. And confuse their language. Now, there's a wonderful play on words here. And, of course, isn't it fitting that in a text that's about language and the unity of purpose of people of one language, and then confusing their language, that there's interlinguistic wordplay in the text? There's actually, because of English, three-language interlinguistic wordplay. The word for confused there is the Hebrew balal. So again, in the three consonants of B, L, and N, you know, it's got the B and the L part. So let's balal their language so they will not understand one another's speech. The divine plan being, of course, you know, if they can't understand each other, their power will be dispersed. And so... the Lord scattered them abroad, exactly what they were afraid would happen, right? In verse 4, otherwise we shall be scattered abroad, and it happens anyway. From over the face of the earth, and they left off building the city. Therefore it was called Babel, which is of course a play on confuse and Balal, because there the Lord confused the language of all the earth. And from there, the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of the earth. And I noted in that initial chart that the word there was important. The word for there and for name is the Hebrew Shem, which is the name of one of the three sons of Noah, that the genealogy in chapter 10 is showing the descendants of. And in English, we don't connect the words there and name. You know, those are not related at all. But they are here. In other words, the descendants of Shem are the Shemites, from which, of course, later we would then have the not quite accurate claim that people who are anti-Jewish are anti-Semitic, which, of course, isn't exactly right, because there are many Shemites who aren't Israelites or Jews. So being anti-Jewish is a smaller thing than being anti-Semitic, if you will. But what's at stake here is this relationship between name and place, which actually has very profound implications if you pause to think about it. Again, the other night we were singing the hymn, "In Jesus Christ There Is No East or West," because one of the most radical things that Jesus does in the Gospels, in all the Gospels in different ways, in a classic way in John 4, where he challenges this woman of Samaria over the question of which mountain is the sacred mountain, the one of the Samaritans where they're standing or the Jerusalem. And he says, neither, because God's seeking people to worship not in Jerusalem or here, but in spirit and truth. You know, one of the most radical things that Jesus did, and I'd suggest one of the reasons why the stories of Jesus don't make the Hebrew Scripture, is disconnect name from place. You know, I mean, what does it mean to be an American apart from this place that we call America or the United States? Name is connected to place. You know, your family name comes from a place that your family is from. And we hold on to those things. You know, much of the struggle in the Middle East today is because in arguments over name and place. Whose place is it? A group called the Palestinians, the Christians, Jews, Muslims, Israelis, over a place. So this is, in Genesis, setting the stage for what Jesus does, is disconnect name from place. Here, in the negative sense, that people would make a name for themselves by having a place where their power to build was expressed. In other words, empire. And so God acts here to scatter that, to spread it out. And to do, of course, what was the plan from Genesis 1 forward, to fill the earth, to multiply and fill the earth, not to concentrate in one place. So the scattering enables a divine purpose to take place, so therefore they're spread over the face of all the earth. Now, the interlinguistic pun, and then I'll stop and we can discuss this if you have questions. So the Hebrew Baalal is confused. The Akkadian Babel is gate of the gods. And of course the English Babel is to talk meaninglessly. In other words, to make sounds that don't match a language exactly. You're just babbling. So we wonderfully in English have that sense that the text is implying here. We use it sort of just loosely about whenever someone's not making sense of their words. But here, it's saying, implicitly at least, the Babylonians are confused. They think their city is the divine realm. It's where the gods live. That the gods have authorized this building project of a city and a palace and a temple. Which is to say, the tower that's being described here would have been in Akkadian, a ziggurat, or in English, a ziggurat, which is the kind of stepped pyramid. In other words, an artificial mountain. So that's what the religious temples in Babylon were, you know, man-made mountains, much like the pyramids of Egypt. And so the text is saying, they're confused. It's not the gate of the gods. It's something that God would scatter and tear down. And that sets not only in the book of Revelation, but throughout the Bible, from Genesis forward, this contrasting and confrontative alternative between the creator's realm and this human-made alternative, each supported by a different religion. So I think I'll stop there, and if you have questions or comments or observations on these two chapters, we can engage that for a little bit.
Wes, I was noticing that in chapter 11, that there seems to be, I've noticed some parallels with chapter 3.
Yeah.
And the Lord comes down to see, and
yeah.
The Lord walked in the garden.
Very good.
And then when the Lord says, look what they've done, there's nothing that now can
yes.
stop them. And in the garden, it's look what they've done, if they eat from the tree of life.
Yeah, very good.
And in both, it's the Lord driving them out.
Yeah, so what's happening at the level of individual people in Genesis 3 is now happening at the level of collective humanity in chapter 11. Nice observation, Brad. Thank you. Others. Yeah.
I'm wondering if we read the story instead of from the position of a dominant group, if we would get a different conclusion. I'm thinking about, say, when it says that we will be scattered if we don't create an edifice or some physical reminder of our culture, thinking about like the Cherokee Nation. When Jackson was trying to relocate them, and they came up with a written language and a legal system, and politics, if there is legitimacy in creating that, if you truly are in danger of being wiped out.
Yeah, that's a great question. Two things to distinguish here. One is this is claiming to be everybody together as all humanity rather than an oppressed people. So when you have an oppressed people, it's a different situation than when you have this attempt of all of humanity to do it together. One of the interesting things on the Cherokee example you give in particular is, you know, the Cherokee in many ways created an identity that tried to conform to what they thought the white people wanted. You know, it had something like a democracy and this form. They thought, maybe Andrew Jackson won't wipe us out if we look more like them. And it was, of course, unsuccessful. But, you know, how much the constructed 19th century Cherokee identity, you know, was authentic and how much it was an attempt to appease an oppressor, you know, by conforming to a certain level while claiming its own identity is an interesting question. I'm not an expert on that context, and maybe you know much more about it than I do, but I know enough to recognize that it's, you know, it wasn't what anybody might call a pure Cherokee culture. It was clearly one that was shaped by what they were perceiving in the surrounding white culture.
Is this story, or one like it, older than the time of the Babylonian captivity? Because it has
simultaneous. That's my point here. Written right precisely in that exilic context.
So it doesn't predate that. There's no oral tradition.
Well, of course, you can't know the answer to that. Oral tradition doesn't leave traces.
Well, it's a very carefully constructed
yes.
story, which would make it easy to remember and to tell.
Sure.
Because of this construct.
Which is to say that even as a written text, the overwhelming majority of people would still experience it orally. You know, amongst Israelites, whoever the actual audience of this is, I mean, two things. The original audience in exile would have been the literate elite. That's who the Babylonians took in exile, after all. It wasn't everybody. I mean, when we defeated the Nazis, we took the scientists, right? We didn't take all the German people. We took Wernher von Braun and people like that, you know, to come and give us the benefit of their brain power for our own purposes. That's who the Babylonians, like any empire, take from captive people. The rest of the people, Babylonians' purpose would be to have them work the land and pay taxes.
Make bricks.
Yeah, make bricks or grow food, and then pay taxes and tribute. But you take the people who have urban skills, and you bring them into the city. So originally, the audience of Genesis would have been people who would have been literate. In the next generation, when Genesis actually has an interestingly subversive role over against the Persian-sponsored rebuilding of Jerusalem, then it would have been heard by people who were not literate. And then all the mnemonic devices and the sound things that make it easily, you know, memorized would come into play more than when it was for people who could actually read it.
This text is paired with Pentecost story.
Yeah.
And I wonder if there's any
if there's any connection for you in terms of the empire creation.
Absolutely.
Stuff. How do you?
Yeah, I was thinking whether I should go there or not, but since you brought it up, let's do it for a minute. Absolutely, Luke's taking the story and reversing it. And yet, not exactly, because in the Pentecost story, it's not that everybody speaks the same language. Everybody hears in their own language. One of the keys to Acts of the Apostles is, and it's there are several examples of that beyond this sort of mission statement-like text that sets the stage for the whole rest of it. Both the Pentecost experience and then Peter's speech that follows, it explains it from Joel, etc., is how do you convey a religious experience to people across cultures? You know, that's a big question. You know, the imperial way of doing it that Western Christianity did is we'll make them learn it in our culture. We'll make them give up their culture, and the message will come in our culture, and they're going to take it in that cultural form. But when you allow it to be translated not just linguistically but culturally to somebody else's culture, what's gained and what's lost? Is it the same message? You know? So take something like Eucharist. Does it need to be bread? Could it be rice? Does it matter? Here at Holden, it doesn't have to be wine. It can be grape juice. But what's gained and what's lost in having a little cafeteria line where you have four several choices? Do you drink from the chalice? Do you get wine in your little cup? Do you get grape juice in your little cup? And then something's lost in terms of unity to honor the diversity of people's attitudes towards alcohol and sanitation and hygiene and things. But if you force it to be united, we all drink from the same cup because that's the important symbol, then we might pass germs and some people are alcoholic and, you know. And if it's the same bread, then some people have gluten allergies, and, you know. And in Asia, should it be rice? And in Mexico or Latin America, should it be corn? Well, huge arguments have been made over those issues because there's not an easy and obvious answer. And that's just one example among countless examples. In Acts, the question is mostly verbal. How do you tell the story in a way that Greeks can understand? How do you tell the story differently to people who expect that this is something just for Israel versus what's quickly revealed that's not just for Israelites who speak different languages, as we see in the Pentecost story, but for non-Israelites who not only don't speak Aramaic or Greek, but have a whole different worldview. One can argue, and if I ever get to volume 2 of my book, I will, that one of the central turning points that made the gospel something very different than what Jesus had in mind was the shift into a context where Greek philosophy was the foundation rather than Israelite anthropology and worldview. In particular, Platonism and Stoicism. And that's what gave us the idea that the primary issue was some incorporeal thing called the soul. And the body was less important. And so when Sue was working with spiritual practices and trying to get us to pay attention to embodiment, for some of us that's very difficult because we may have inherited a Greek way of hearing the gospel that says, but our body's dirty or not important or something else, and what's really important is this thing called our soul. Well, if you'd said that to Jesus, he would have no idea what you were talking about. But then Greeks read scriptures and you hear the flesh is meaningless in John 6:63, or you hear Paul talking about the contrast between flesh and the spirit, and instead of hearing that as a metaphorical pair connected to Genesis 2, you hear it through Platonic philosophy and hear the body is bad and the soul is what matters. Well, it has huge implications 2,000 years later of how did you translate this gospel to have it be heard by a Greek audience. And Luke's making that question one of his central questions throughout this gospel, not the specific one of Stoic philosophy, but how do you tell it? So, you know, so he has, for example, in that wonderful scene in chapter 10, I won't bring it up now, chapter 10 and 11, where Peter has this visionary experience while he's standing on the roof waiting for lunch of a big sheet full of animals, and he thinks it's about food. Of course, it's not about food. Meanwhile, the Roman centurion Cornelius has this vision, and Cornelius sends his people to Peter, and Peter goes to there, and they're all retelling different stories, and you as readers get to hear how the story's retold differently. And then Peter says, breakthrough, I see that God shows no partiality, and you know it's all open to everybody now, including Roman centurions. And then before he can get back to Jerusalem, this quote-unquote circumcised believers hear that he ate with a Gentile. And when he tells the story, he doesn't say anything about a Roman centurion. You know, he leaves that part out. Is he lying? Or is he telling the story in a way that they can hear? If they heard Roman centurion, they'd say, you're out of your mind! Roman centurions? This isn't for Roman centurions. And Luke puts those two stories right next to each other and leaves readers to go, what about how Peter tells it? Is that manipulation? Is it shaping it so that you can hear it? Where is the line there? He doesn't answer. He invites you to grapple with that. So that question of how it translates linguistically and culturally is not an answerable one, but one that we really have to grapple with. Because when we don't, we end up being culturally imperialistic, as we see Western history has been. One last thing. I know we're out of time here.
Interesting example of that. When the Jesuits were teaching the Messiah, they discovered that the Messiah despised sheep and shepherds. And Lamb of God did not translate. So they ended up calling Jesus Chicken of God.
And the Jesuits, bless their holy name, you know, I work at Seattle University. You know, we're on the forefront in many places, in Japan and in China and other places, of saying we need to enter into this culture deeply before we can begin to know how to talk about the gospel to people of a very different culture. Anyway. Well, thank you for listening. Tomorrow we'll look at chapters 12 and 13. Again, if you'd like to write something in the book today or tomorrow, I'll leave it up here for a few minutes.